Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Lauren Levitt. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Riverside's Excite Center for Teaching and Learning.
Fantastic to have you here, Lauren. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, are you standing? Am I right in thinking you're standing? Or are you sitting?
Standing. I'm standing, yes.
This is
I'm standing.
apparently a very healthy way of interacting with computer screens.
I have a back injury, so it makes it hard for me to sit down for a long time.
But I think to avoid back injuries, this can be a good practice too, right?
Yes, probably I would not be having a back injury if I had not had to sit down so much during my PhD program.
So thanks for the back health induction. That's handy. I'm wondering if you could share with us a wee bit, Prof, what's going on for you at the moment in terms of what is preoccupying, dynamizing, interesting you?
Okay, well, I think the thing that is most interesting me at the moment is the sort of second project that I'm starting to work on. I am starting a project that's about sex workers' cultural production, broadly speaking. Both traditional and digital media, as well as things like memoir, art, and so on. And so there is a sex tech conference that's online. It's coming up, I believe, in the fall, and there's a call for papers due in the summer. And so I am working on a paper for that, and it's going to be about sex workers' digital zines. So I've been reading a lot of sex worker zines lately. So I'm gonna write something for that that's about, sex workers' digital zines. So that is very interesting to me right
And are they written for one another, for customers, for everybody? What's the who's the zine for, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about sex worker cultural production is, depending on what it is, it can be for an audience of sex workers, or it can be for the general public, or it can be both. And so the zines that I'm looking at are addressed to a variety of different types of people. Some of them are addressed only to sex workers or to potential sex workers. Some of them are addressed to allies. Some of them are addressed to both of these groups of people, and then some of them are addressed to like a more general public. So that is quite interesting and one of the features of the themes that I would like to examine.
And presumably, in the availability of these different types of zine is a bit restricted in some cases and is very public in others.
Yeah, so zines are interesting because they're a kind of not very old, but fairly, it's an older form of DIY media. I mean that like older than blogs, older than social media. So they were created to sort of like get around the sort of limitations of production for marginalized people. So in a sense, they, that zines were created to get around that. Zines now, some of them are available in person. Some of them are available online. So when we're thinking about online zines, some of them are zines that have been digitized. So somebody has scanned them. So there's a Troy named Genderless who has a zine archive. They're an archivist and they have a zine archive and they have a collection of like sex worker zines. And some of them are born digital and some of them have been digitized. So the digital ones, I'm thinking of the digital ones as in the ones that were born digital. There's others that, you have not been digitized yet, and so you have to purchase them or get them in person, right? The ones that are born digital, obviously it takes more technical skills, or rather different technical skills to produce them, right? You have to have a computer, you have to know how to use a computer, whereas, a print zine you could make with just a photocopier, right? Like, it doesn't even have to be typeset or anything. You can literally just make it with construction paper and markers. But so
And a
you do have
stapler.
what?
And a stapler.
And a stapler, right? Yes, and a stapler. But the digital ones, you need more types of like technical know-how, I guess, or different types of technical know-how. But the distribution is easier, right? So this is one of the key differences in the sort of material aspects of these things.
I'm thinking back, I guess the first time I encountered the word zine, short for magazine in those days, I guess it's almost lost that history now, was in the punk era when these things were very important. And they were, I mean, they literally were, they weren't even Xerox, they were just Roneoed and then stapled together in many cases with patchy photos. But some of that aesthetic is still present online, I think, very much.
Oh yeah, totally. I think that the born digital zines that I've seen have mostly been like they have been typeset, and they usually have some sort of graphic design. But a lot of the physical zines that have been digitized, they have collage, they have things that have been handwritten. So there's all types of this kind of like DIY aesthetic. And yeah, as far as I understand, like zines were originally fanzines, so that it started out punk music fanzines and then media fanzines, and then they have, morphed into this kind of like type of political communication, really.
I think that's true. I definitely encountered them first through punk, but then years later, I discovered what we would call fanzines that were produced about TV shows in the late 60s.
Yes. Stuff that Henry Jenkins writes about in Textual Poachers.
Quite possibly, but I found them in libraries and things with reference to TV shows. And in
Wow.
fact, Gary Crowdus, who for
Okay.
years edited Cineast, maybe he still does.
Okay.
He had a TV fanzine that was fantastic in the late 60s that was very artisanal.
Oh, so they were made in the 60s.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Oh.
You bet. And in fact, when I met him, I was able to say, oh, well, so you're the editor of Cineast, great journal slash magazine, but I read your zine from 1969.
Yeah, and I guess that you could argue that like some of the homophile movement's publications were really zines because they weren't, they were created and distributed through, right? They weren't, published through a publisher because they couldn't be. I mean, I think the stuff that you're talking about, like these like DIY fan magazines from the 50s, and either even some earlier forms of media, maybe even some types of newsletters, we could think of them as zines, or at least like a predecessor to zines.
Yes, I don't think they had any sort of political heft to them, whereas the punk ones at least implicitly did, and often in gender terms, I think, much as anything. Whereas I guess the homophilic stuff would have had an implicit and sometimes explicit political agenda, and the stakes would have been much higher, obviously, in the days of criminalization and so on.
Right. And I think those organizations were political. They were to mainstream, homosexuality, quote unquote. So they were political organizations.
So on to the ones that you're looking at now. Are you looking at all the different kinds of audiences that are being addressed, or are there some in particular that you're focusing on?
So right now I'm just trying to read as broadly as I can and get a general sense of who the different audiences are. I would say, Sex worker media in general is frequently addressed to other sex workers, but sometimes it's addressed to other people because it's doing some kind of political work, right? But I think, and I think we see this the same thing going on in zines, although I have noticed that there are a fair number of zines that are specifically addressed to allies, which is interesting and something that maybe I hadn't expected going into this project.
That is interesting. And are these mostly US based?
It's actually a range. So there's a number that I've been reading that are US based, and then there's others that are out of the UK. I'm trying to think if they're ones from other country. I can't off of the top of my head think about it, but I know that there are some zines that include so for example, there's this one zine that I believe it's called Brazen, a sex worker rights zine. And it was made by SWOP New York City or a founding member of SWOP New York City, but it has it's kind of an anthology zine, so it's not just written by one person. It has
Right.
submissions from lots of different organizations and people, and the organizations are from all over.
And
International organizations, like there's one from Brazil, and I think there might be New Zealand or something in that zine as well.
in terms of what you've read, are there things there that are surprising you, that are new to you, or is this in line with other things that are known about cultural production by sex workers?
Well, I mean, like I said, it's a new project, and the really interesting thing about it is there isn't a ton of work on it yet. So that's exciting because it's very new. But I don't think that I came in with any expectations other than the expectations I have from the content that I have consumed in the past, right? I don't know if it's surprising, but one thing that has been interesting and like I said, a lot of this I got. So I asked for to find the stuff, I asked for community recommendations and I got a bunch from different social media platforms. And so I like sought out the things that people recommended to me. And also that's how I met Jen Derless, who has this archive. So some of what I'm finding might be a result of Jen's archival practices, right? What they choose to collect.
Right.
But so there's generally, I think, like two different types of zines. So info zines, informational zines, and per zines or personal zines. And in the,
Perzines. I don't know that
and
term.
yeah, per zine, I think they call it. They're personal experience zines.
Ah, yeah, right.
Zine category, I've been finding a lot of per zines that are about types of people who are not typically represented in mainstream sex worker media. So I've read a number of per zines that are about trans males, trans men, or trans masculine sex workers. So that's been interesting to see, these sex worker zines kind of like filling this gap or this absence in the more mainstream sex worker media.
And when you look at the forms of writing or pictorial art or whatever, are you seeing differences that you might attribute to class or education or racial difference?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So like I said, especially in these per zines, but I mean the per zine info zine, a lot of them cross over and are kind of both categories at once. Like there'll be zines that they'll say, my aim number one is to talk about my personal experience, and my aim number two is to give people information if they're considering entering the sex industry or something like that. So they're not always completely discrete categories. But especially the per zines, but also often the info zines really highlight positionality. So people like talk about where it is they're coming from as kind of like a political move, I guess. But yes, that is also reflected in the, writing style as well. And
And do people are people addressing I think you may have mentioned this already, actually, things like criminalization and police violence and so on.
Absolutely.
And what about gendered violence? I imagine there's a fair bit of discussion of that issue
Yeah.
of male violence.
I'm trying to think if it's, well, I mean, I don't know if it's framed in that way, but there is discussion, I know, of gender-based violence or relationship violence, however you want to frame that. So things like domestic abuse, or child abuse, or police violence, or violence from clients, or whatever. But I don't know if it's always framed. I'm trying to think. I can't think of off the top of my head of a zine that frames it in terms of like male violence against women, because like I said, a lot of these zines are not necessary, like a lot of them are written by trans men, so you know, and that's like what would kind of male violent, like in that context, that paradigm doesn't really work.
Understood. So, and is pleasure, this is my last sort of, question out of total ignorance, is pleasure part of what is that one of the themes at all? Is it there?
I'm trying to think. You know, I'm sure it is. I mean, I'm sure there are people that say that they like their jobs or that they enjoy their jobs in some way. In these zines, it's not the thing that sticks out to me the most, though, because sort of the mainstream, sex workers' rights movement often relies on this kind of framing to justify the existence of sex work, right? And there are people who are advocating for sex worker rights who maybe have experienced violence. And so they feel kind of silenced by the sort of mainstream sex workers' rights movement. So there are a lot of people who are talking about their experiences of trauma, like in these zines, because they don't feel like there's like a space for it in like dominant discourse, right? So I'm sure there are people who talk about, you know, liking their jobs or maybe like the reasons they do their jobs, some of the things they enjoy about their jobs, but it's also a space where people can talk about what they don't like about their jobs and like maybe some of the negative things that they've experienced as well.
My recollection from 15 or 20 years ago, Prof, is that there was the publication of a number of ethnographic accounts of, in particular, I think what was called exotic dancing, where
Yeah.
people had done this to pay for college, to pay for grad school, and then wrote their PhDs on their experiences. This was quite a trend from what I remember.
I can think of, I mean, maybe they wrote, there may have been a number of PhDs. I've heard a number of students who have written, you know, theses or dissertations on the topic. I know there's at least one book. I have it on my bookshelf right here. I have not read it yet. Let's see if I can find it. It is, this one, Elizabeth Eves, Bayer, The Naked Truth About Stripping. So this, I don't know if it's ethnographic. So I'm reading the back. I thought it was ethnographic. It says she has a master's in international affairs from Columbia and has worked as a journalist for Reuters. Lives in DC. So I'm not sure. I haven't read this one yet, but I think that this kind of falls into that category. There have been a number of sex worker memoirs that have been published over the years. Some of these people are highly educated as well. So that's like These were like the two types of writing that I started with, the zines on the one hand and the memoirs on the other. I'm also interested in like journalism because there are a number of like sex worker journalists that mostly do digital journalism, but that's, I haven't really started
Internet, yeah.
getting into all that yet. But
And
yeah, so there are
initially,
memoirs. I think the because dancing, stripping is legal, because it is a legal aspect of the sex industry, I think it's something that there's more, a lot more content about, because obviously people don't want to disclose if they've been a criminalized worker. And you know, so I think that's why maybe there's more written about dancing than anything else so far.
that's an interesting point. Of course, because it counts as protected speech under the First Amendment in the United States, but towns are allowed to require that places where people dance or strip are can be, in the boonies.
Yeah, it's mostly regulated by zoning laws, you're correct. And but also there's a lot of other types of laws that are usually determined on the local level about licensing, about, you know, whether you can serve alcohol in clubs. So when I say licensing, I mean like whether dancers have to have a license to work in the club, rules about contact with customers, how far away you have to be when giving a dance, all kinds of rules that are organized at the sort of local or municipal level for the most part. I think there is some of that that's at the state level as well. But yeah, it's regulated mostly in that way. And there are raids on strip clubs all the time for violating, you know, any one of these rules, or just, you know, in generally under suspicion that like prostitution, quote unquote, is happening.
Is occurring. And my sense is that probably amongst these memoirs and a lot of the journalism and so on, in the main, this has been women who've been working in the sex industry, dancing mostly for men. And more recently, it's become more trans activist and gay activist.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think about it. Actually, you know, in terms of the memoirs, they're a little more diverse than that, I would say. There are a lot of dancer memoirs, but there's also a lot of sex worker memoirs, you know, from like the prostitutes' rights movement in the 1970s, people who came out of that movement. So like I have a book here that I haven't read yet, but I'm going to read it, Dolores French's Working. Also, you know, Norma Jean Almodovar's From Cop to Call Girl, which she's actually working on a sequel to it right now. And you know, there's a lot of memoirs written by dominatrixes, by escorts, by all different types of sex workers. And in terms of trans representation, I can't think of anything that I've read off the top of my head, but I do have this book that I have not yet read, which is called Las Beauty Queens, spelled Biuty. It's Ivana Ojeda, who it's translated. I think it was written in Spanish, I believe. Hold on, let me check that. Maybe it's not. Check. Yes, it's translated from the Spanish, but they are a playwright, I believe, from, is it somewhere in Latin America? It might have been, I don't remember where they're from, but they moved to New York City to do some kind of like arts, what is it called? Residency, I believe, as a playwright. And they met a bunch of transgender people in New York City, Latina transgender people, I think maybe non-Latinas as well, but I think they met this group of kind of Latina transgender people, women in New York City, and they were all, street-based sex workers. And so, Yvonne also became a street-based sex worker. And so this book is kind of like stories about those people. So they're, I think it is a little more diverse than just, exotic dancers or whatever.
And in terms of the publishers, are they zine-like? Are they self-published? Are they mass market? Are they university presses? I mean, who's bringing these things out?
So, a number of them are on mainstream presses. But I think that the proliferation recently of independent publishing has also helped a lot of these get published. So some of them are on more mainstream publishers, but then there are others that are, like on smaller independent presses as
That's
well.
interesting. Yeah.
The
And
only one that I can think of that was self-published is there's this one from like, I think it's the 60s. It's called My Life as a Honolulu Prostitute. And it is an ex-madam who I think got shut down by the cops or something and just like writes this horrible expose of sort of brothels in Hawaii and like after World War II, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. So that one was self-published. I think that's like the earliest one. And then, or maybe it was earlier than that. And then there's another one that's like Detroit or Motor City Madam, that's about this madam from Detroit, like in mid-century madam. And that one I think did get published actually, formally. But it's one that circulates as a zine.
When I was in high school, there was the Happy Hooker.
The
This was
Happy Hooker, who wrote that?
Xaviera Hollander.
Okay.
And it was enormously successful. I think there may have been a couple of sequels, and she brought out a record or two. And it
Okay.
was something that people talked about. A lot, got a lot of attention. It would have been early 1970s, I think.
Yeah, I feel like that's like the around the time that this all started really picking up and getting kind of like mainstream publication, right? Is probably around the 70s or the 80s, coinciding with the prostitutes' rights movement and also kind of like the mainstreaming of porn and a lot of other stuff.
Yes. So, but it sounds as though there is an efflorescence happening now, and
Yes, there is.
very varied. Do you have any sense of why that might be?
That is a really good question. I think like post Sesta Fosta, there's been a bit of a renaissance of sex worker organizing in the United States and also abroad, just coming up against the sort of regressive legislation. I think that's motivating some of it. I think some of it is like has to do with technology, right? That there's new technology available that people can use to disseminate their stories, their ideas. But I'm not entirely sure. I don't want to speculate too much on that yet because I don't feel like I've really done enough research to definitively say. But I think maybe those are two factors that might be playing into it.
For sure. And Prof, you told us this is a fairly new project, your second project, which
Yes.
must beg the question, please tell us about your first.
Yes, so I am writing a book that is about sex workers' networks of care. So it looks at the caring and sharing practices of sex workers and sex worker organizers in New York and Los Angeles. It shows how they care for each other physically and emotionally, and also share knowledge and material resources with each other to combat stigma, precarity, and criminalization. So that is what my book project is about.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah.
And are these networks formal or are they less formal?
Oh, I write about both actually. So the majority of the book is about informal networks that emerge organically at workplaces. But then in the final chapter, I look at a case study of sex worker organizing, the networks built by sex worker organizing, and how they kind of like extend the caring and sharing practices, the that emerge in organically among workers. So yeah, so I'm kind of looking at the affordances and limitations of both types of network.
And what period is this covering?
Contemporary United States.
Contemporary. And how did you find out about these things? I mean, is this ethnographic research where you're interviewing people and then people put you on to others that you might speak to, or?
Yeah, so the first three chapters. So the main portion of the book is based on interviews that I did with sex workers, most of whom worked at a particular dungeon in New York City. And so I knew some people who were working there, and so it was a matter of access, and then they were able to, refer me to other people who worked there. So I kind of tried to get a snapshot of like the relationships among like a core group of people. But in Los Angeles, I was very involved in the Los Angeles chapter of the Sex Workers Outreach Project for a number of years. And so that the last chapter is a kind of ethnographic case study based on participant observation for the most part.
Right, and that's the formal network part.
Exactly, yes.
So I'd like to get back to that in a moment if we can. Not that I want to steal the thunder of the book before it's out. But for some listeners who may not be familiar, could you explain what is meant by the dungeon in New
So,
York?
a dungeon is a space for BDSM play. So, it is a place where you can go. You can, if it's private, it can be like somewhat one that belongs to a person, like in their house or something, or it can be one where you can rent space, and it usually has some kind of BDSM equipment in it, like a St. Andrew's cross or a spanking bench or whatever. Sometimes they also have like implements that you can borrow. And the one that I am writing about is a commercial dungeon. So you can go there and hire the services of a BDSM professional.
And BDSM stands for.
A bondage discipline. Sadomasochism, dominant submission.
So the reason I'm asking you these things is that in terms of listenership, about 50% of listeners are native English speakers, or at least live Native English speaking countries, about
Yes.
the plurality in the US, but not the majority. So I'm always wanting to give a bit of extra context,
Yes.
people, especially with things like acronyms.
Yes. I don't know how widespread the BDSM acronym is. I read a paper the other day that was about attachment styles and BDSM roles in China. So, like the practices are widespread. I don't know. What the terminology
Yes,
is.
well, a friend of mine who writes novels of this kind, and been very involved in the culture for a very long time. He was telling me that one of the acronyms people in the culture use now is TTWD.
Oh, what does that stand for?
That thing we do.
Okay. Interesting.
I'm not sure if this is commercial. I think this is more in the subculture, if you like. But it means
Right.
you just say TTWD, and the other person either will not know or will know.
Okay.
I think it's a good one. I like TTWD a lot. In any event, yes, these things are very interesting. So, in other words, in the very commercial zone, there can be networks of care that are about telling people about good, safe practices or being psychologically supportive.
Yeah, there's a lot of psychological support. There is, physical care, in the case of like illness or injury, aftercare after a session, sharing, yeah, not just like safe practices, but also like how to do the job, how to make more money, helping people make more money. And then there's also like sharing food, sharing medicine, sharing housing. Because a lot of times these workers are marginalized in other ways as well. Like they may have food insecurity or insecure housing.
Right. And this is very much operating in the informal sector. So I guess they're probably not paying taxes and probably not getting health care.
Definitely no healthcare. That is for sure. In terms of people paying taxes, I think it depends. Some people report all their income because, they're interested in buying a house or something, and so they need to have their income on paper, and so they pay self-employment tax or they set up an LLC as an entertainer. Other people probably don't pay taxes. I don't really know, but I think it's more of like an individual thing. But if they are paying taxes, they're paying self-employment taxes. Like their employer is definitely not, paying taxes for them. And even there are some places where, it might be on the books. Like their employer might even say, like, you were paid this much, but then you're still responsible for like filing your taxes yourself.
Right. And I should say, when I said healthcare, what I meant was health insurance. And when you said LLC, that means limited liability company. So it's interesting. There is a certain formalization of work at some levels, depending on either how corporate it all is or what the person's motivations may be, which could be not traditional informal sector ones. They could be much more about regularizing oneself, normalizing oneself.
Yeah, like I said, I think the setting up an LLC, I think a lot of times that's about, paying taxes and stuff like that.
Yeah, right. And on to the Los Angeles experience and the personal observation with the more formal group. Could you share with us something about that and the differences, the similarities between that and the New York story?
So I think both kinds of networks are important, right? I think we need both. The formal organizing, it's able to reach a broader group of people because these informal networks are limited in size, just out of necessity because trust is really important there. And the stakes are quite high, right? Like you could get arrested potentially. So trust is really important, and so the networks can't kind of expand beyond, a core group of people who all know each other. But these more formal networks, these activist networks, they can reach a much broader group of people, right? And they can do things like influence policy. I feel like policy is a bit of a double bind. Like sometimes it can do things that are positive, but other times it can, give more resources to the police or waste people's energy and resources on changes that are only symbolic. So I think that organizers have to be careful about what kind of policy they choose to engage with, policy advocacy. I think that the informal networks are much more effective at like meeting the its members' sort of like everyday needs. But I think that there is also a place for formal organizing, like I said, because it can have more of a structural impact and because it can reach a broader group of people. But I think organizers also have to be really careful about burnout as well.
What would you say are some of the key policy initiatives that have been taken or that could be taken?
Well, I think in general, the like sex workers' rights movement is mostly advocating for decriminalization, rather than like legalization. I think that's a first step. It's a good first step, but it isn't like the end because obviously, the criminalization of sex work is really the criminalization of poverty. And so, decriminalizing it might help some people, but it's not going to help people who are experiencing racial violence, who are experiencing economic violence, and stuff like that. So we need other sort of ways to deal with that as well. So, resources to people, like, education, healthcare, like income, childcare, like all those kinds of things. But I think that for the most part, organizations, when they're dealing with policy, they're dealing with decriminalization or steps towards decriminalization.
And can I ask about the relationship to other social movements? One in particular I'm thinking of is feminism, because historically a lot of workers in these situations have been women.
Yeah, there's like a fraught relationship, I would say, between the sex workers' rights movement and feminism, especially academic feminism, that, goes back to, I would probably say, probably the 70s and 80s. Because I think early on, like the Marxist feminists in a lot of ways were supportive of sex workers. But then, in the 80s, a lot of radical feminists kind of saw sex workers as like gender traitors. And they were very concerned with representation and how representation was violence. And that led to, what we often refer to as the feminist sex wars. So, like anti-porn feminists versus what people call pro-sex feminists who supported sex workers, but again, it was like it wasn't about like the sort of it wasn't framed in terms of labor. It was framed in terms of like pleasure and sexual liberation for the most part, and then that has morphed into trafficking debates. So a lot of the people who were very active in sort of anti-porn feminism have become active in the anti-sex trafficking movement. And there's this kind of presumption that all sex work is sex trafficking because nobody could choose sex work, like that it that all sex work is necessarily coerced because it's impossible to choose. And I think Gail Rubin, I think, is writing about that in her memoir right now, kind of like reflecting back on those debates from like the 80s. and 90s and how it relates to the kind of anti-trafficking movement today.
And that trafficking movement sometimes uses the word abolition to describe its goals.
Yes, which is terrible. It's the worst thing ever. It's such a co-optation of, like abolition of slavery, and a lot of people have written about it. But yeah, and I think that like a lot of feminist academics are, second wave feminists who are, anti-sex work. And so I think that that's caused a lot of distrust within the sex worker rights movement and just among sex workers, many of whom I think are feminists, but wouldn't necessarily claim that for themselves just because of the ways that they've been harmed.
I guess delegitimized would be a
Yeah, but they've also been materially harmed. Like a lot of these anti-trafficking organizations sponsored SESTA-FOSTA, which has caused like real material hardships to people. So I think it's not just delegitimization, it's like material and physical harm that have come to people as well.
And that's their experience of academic feminism.
Yes. So there is some distrust, I think.
Right. So when you're doing a PhD in LA, is it a bit hard to gain people's faith?
I think that because I was actively involved in organizing, that people trusted me more. I think it really doesn't take a lot to gain people's trust. Like we would all the time have people, journalists, a lot student journalists, who would contact us, and they would want an interview yesterday, and it wasn't paid, and people would have to show their faces and all this crazy stuff. And I would always tell them, like, come to a meeting. They would be like, oh, I can't because this deadline, blah blah blah, I have to do it now. And I'd be like, no, but like everybody who came to a meeting and introduced themselves and made their intentions clear, people were very generous with them. It just takes a little bit. You just need to show up, volunteer maybe, or even just attend a meeting. And just being there in person, people can see your face and you assuring people that, you're interested in destigmatizing, or you want to, highlight the voices of workers or whatever it is, that goes a long way, I think.
That's interesting. That's really, really interesting. So, Prof, I've got a couple more questions, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed. Does that sound okay?
That sounds great.
So, my first one is about how one goes about finding these things out. And you've already told us that you're doing textual analysis of the zines and that you did ethnography for the first book. Are there other things that you do in order to discover stuff?
In terms of my methods, well, I would say I have some training in cultural history, so I'm really thinking about this new project as a cultural history in a way, sort of getting at that question that you asked before, which is, why now? Why is there this huge renaissance now? And there have been other periods in the time where there has been a lot of media, or cultural production. Like you mentioned, the 1970s, and then there was a time like around, like before FOSTA-SESTA, like early 2010s, where there was also a lot of stuff being produced. Like, why is this stuff being published when it's being published? What does it reflect about like broader historical processes? So I think there's like a cultural history question in there as well. I'm trying to think if there are any other, obviously there are other methods in my toolbox, but I think for this project, the one I'm working on now, it's mainly going to be cultural history, textual analysis, thematic analysis, and maybe some interviews.
It's a terrific project, I think, and combining those things is very valuable. And so my last question before throwing to you, Prof, is to ask you about your current job. What's it like? What are you doing? And what is Excite?
Okay, so Excite is, it's technically the Center for Teaching and Learning at UCR, but it's really an innovation center. And I am working with Richard Edwards, who is the director of the center, and some other PIs, both at UCR and UCSD, so University of California, San Diego, on an NSF-funded research project about STEM pedagogy. So we're looking at teaching observation protocols for STEM, trying to find out how instructors make sense of them and whether they have impact specifically on equity over time. So, we're doing obviously, teaching observations. We're doing interviews. We're doing a survey. So it's mixed methods. It's qualitative and quantitative. And so that's what I'm working on right now.
And just to explain some acronyms, PI, Principal Investigator, NSF, National Science Foundation, STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Medicine.
Yes.
I think a lot of
Quite a
people will know some of those acronyms, but a lot
Sorry
won't.
about
So, no,
that.
it's okay. I heard you say PI, NSF, STEM, and I'm thinking, yes, now I do know what those things are. It's an interesting, no, I think that sounds like a very interesting and important project. And I know I was going to throw it to you, but I had one more question that relates to that. It's quite different from the work you're currently doing for your, in inverted commas, own research. Do you find it's refreshing to be able to have such a difference between part of your job and another part of your job?
A lot of what I'm doing on this project is project management. And I'm also the kind of the social science researcher because everybody else, well, Richard Edwards is obviously like cinema and media studies scholar, but everybody else is a science educator of some kind or a STEM educator of some kind. So I feel like my role is the person that has a kind of social science research background. And indeed, that's how we met as well, because I was working on a project with Vicky Mayer at Tulane about creative industries in New Orleans and Tel Aviv, right? So I have experience doing project management and social science research. And so I think those skills are transferable. The project that I'm working on now, it's interesting to me because, well, one, it concerns equity, which, my work is also concerned with, but also because I'm able to learn more about mixed methods research, which I have less experience in. So those are some of the things that are appealing to me about the project.
It sounds great. And are there things you'd like to add that we've not touched on fully or not touched on at all?
Yes, I'm on the job market. You can hire me. Please hire me. That's
Well,
it.
that no, that's a very good thing to raise. Yeah. That's a very good thing to raise. We should make this a job laboratory, a job advertisement place. What sorts of, and tell me, Professor, what sorts of work are you looking for?
I'm looking pretty broadly. I think I'm looking at media studies jobs, obviously, and I'm looking at gender and sexuality studies jobs. But I'm also open to other types of departments, like I'm in English departments that have a focus on media. I'm, similarly comparative literature departments that might have a focus on media or like digital humanities or something. I'm open to sociology departments that are interested in, sociology of gender, sociology of media, anthropology departments who are interested in those things, criminology, labor studies. There are many, many kinds of departments that I am open to working in.
We'll work for food, right?
Exactly.
Well, Prof, thank you very much. It was great chatting to you. I really learned a lot about something where I'm not very knowledgeable and that I think is a very important cultural, social, political part of life. So greatly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was fun.